find it hard to be so brutal. Concentrate on their friends, their circumstances, the externals of their lives. There are many legends of Don Juan, but they often describe him seducing a village girl by making her feel that her life is horribly provincial. He, meanwhile, wears glittering clothes and has a noble bearing. Strange and exotic, he's always from somewhere else. First, she feels the boredom of her life. Then, she sees him as her salvation. Remember, people prefer to feel that if their life is uninteresting, it's not because of themselves, but because of their circumstances. The dull people they know, the town into which they were born. Once you make them feel the lure of the exotic, seduction is easy. Another devilishly seductive area to aim at is the victim's past. To grow old is to renounce or compromise youthful ideals, to become less spontaneous, less alive, in a way. This knowledge lies dormant in all of us. As a seducer, you must bring it to the surface, make it clear how far people have strayed from their past goals and ideals. You, in turn, present yourself as representing that ideal, as offering a chance to recapture lost youth through adventure, through seduction. In her later years, Queen Elizabeth I of England was known as a rather stern and demanding ruler. She made it a point not to let her courtiers see anything soft or weak in her. But then Robert Devereux, the second Earl of Essex, came to court. Much younger than the Queen, the dashing Essex would often chastise her for her sourness. The Queen would forgive him. He was so exuberant and spontaneous, he could not control himself. But his comments got under her skin. In the presence of Essex, she came to remember all the youthful ideals, spiritedness, feminine charm, that had since vanished from her life. She also felt a little of that girlish spirit return when she was around him. He quickly became her favorite, and soon she was in love with him. Old age is constantly seduced by youth, but first, the young people must make it clear what the older ones are missing, how they have lost their ideals. Only then will they feel that the presence of the young will let them recapture that spark, the rebellious spirit that age and society have conspired to repress. This concept has infinite applications. Corporations and politicians know that they cannot seduce their public into buying what they want them to buy or doing what they want them to do unless they first awaken a sense of need and discontent. Make the masses uncertain about their identity, and you can help define it for them. It is as true of groups or nations as it is of individuals. They cannot be seduced without being made to feel some lack. Part of John F. Kennedy's election strategy in 1960 was to make Americans unhappy about the 1950s and how far the country had strayed from its ideals. In talking about the 1950s, he didn't mention the nation's economic stability or its emergence as a superpower. Instead, he implied that the period was marked by conformity, a lack of risk and adventure, a loss of our frontier values. To vote for Kennedy was to embark on a collective adventure, to go back to ideals we had given up. But before anyone joined his crusade, they had to be made aware of how much they had lost, what was missing. A group, like an individual, can get mired in routine, losing track of its original goals. Too much prosperity saps it of strength. You can seduce an entire nation by aiming at its collective insecurity, that latent sense that not everything is what it seems. Stirring dissatisfaction with the present and reminding people about the glorious past can unsettle their sense of identity. Then you can be the one to redefine it. A grand seduction. Reversal. If you go too far in lowering the target's self-esteem, they may feel too insecure to enter into your seduction. Do not be heavy-handed. Like Lawrence, Always follow up the wounding attack with a soothing gesture. Otherwise, you will simply alienate them. Charm is often a subtler and more effective route to seduction. The Victorian Prime Minister, Benjamin Disraeli, always made people feel better about themselves. He deferred to them, made them the center of attention, made them feel witty and vibrant. He was a boon to their vanity, and they grew addicted to him. This is a kind of diffused seduction, lacking intention and in the deep emotions that the sexual variety stirs. It bypasses people's hunger, their need for some kind of fulfillment. But if you're subtle and clever, it can be a way of lowering their defenses, creating an unthreatening friendship. Once they are under your spell in this way, you can then open the wound. Indeed, after Disraeli had charmed Queen Victoria and established a friendship with her, he made her feel vaguely inadequate in the establishment of an empire and the realization of her ideals. Everything depends on the target. People who are riddled with insecurities may require the gentler variety. Once they feel comfortable with you, aim your arrows. Chapter 6. Master the Art of Insinuation. Making your targets feel dissatisfied and in need of your attention is essential, but if you are too obvious, they will see through you and grow defensive. There is no known defense, however, against insinuation, the art of planting ideas in people's minds by dropping elusive hints that take root days later, even appearing to them as their own idea. Insinuation is the supreme means of influencing people. Create a sublanguage, bold statements followed by retraction and apology, ambiguous comments, banal talk combined with alluring glances that enters the target's unconscious to convey your real meaning. Make everything suggestive. Insinuating desire. One evening in the 1770s, a young man went to the Paris Opera to meet his lover, a countess. The couple had been fighting, and he was anxious to see her again. The countess had not arrived yet at her box, but from an adjacent one, a friend of hers called out to the young man to join her, remarking that it was an excellent stroke of luck that they had met that evening. He must keep her company on a trip she had to take. The young man wanted urgently to see the countess, but Madame was charming and insistent, and he agreed to go with her. Before he could ask why or where, she quickly escorted him to her carriage outside, which then sped off. Now, the young man enjoined his hostess to tell him where she was taking him. At first, she just laughed, but finally she told him, to her husband's chateau. The couple had been estranged, but had decided to reconcile. Her husband was a bore, however, and she felt a charming young man like himself would liven things up. The young man was intrigued. Madame was an older woman with a reputation for being rather formal, though he also knew she had a lover, a marquis. Why had she chosen him for this excursion? Her story was not quite credible. Then, as they traveled, she suggested he look out the window at the passing landscape, as she was doing. He had to lean over toward her to do so, and just as he did, the carriage jolted. She grabbed his hand and fell into his arms. She stayed there for a moment, then pulled away from him rather abruptly. After an awkward silence, she said, "Do you intend to convince me of my imprudence in your regard?" He protested that the incident had been an accident and reassured her he would behave himself. In truth, however, having her in his arms had made him think otherwise. They arrived at the chateau. The husband came to meet them, and the young man expressed his admiration of the building. "What you see is nothing," Madame interrupted. "I must take you to Monsieur's apartment." Before he could ask what she meant, the subject was quickly changed. The husband was indeed a bore, but he excused himself after supper. Now Madame and the young man were alone. She invited him to walk with her in the gardens. It was a splendid evening, and as they walked, she slipped her arm in his. She wasn't worried that he would take advantage of her, she said, because she knew how attached he was to her good friend, the Countess. They talked of other things, and then she returned to the topic of his lover.
"Is she making you quite happy?"
"Oh, I fear the contrary, and this distresses me. Are you not often the victim of her strange whims?" she said.
To the young man's surprise, Madame began to talk of the Countess in a way that made it seem that she had been unfaithful to him, which was something he had suspected. Madame sighed. She regretted saying such things about her friend, and asked him to forgive her. Then, as if a new thought had occurred to her, she mentioned a nearby pavilion, a delightful place, full of pleasant memories. But the shame of it was locked, and she had no key. And yet, they found their way to the pavilion, and lo and behold, the door had been left open. It was dark inside, but the young man could sense that it was a place for trysts. They entered and sank onto a sofa, and before he knew what had come over him, he took her in his arms. Madame seemed to push him away, but then gave in. Finally, she came to her senses. They must return to the house. Had he gone too far? He must try to control himself. As they strolled back to the house, Madame remarked, "What a delicious night we've just spent." Was she referring to what had happened in the pavilion? "There is an even more charming room in the chateau," she went on, "but I can't show you anything," implying he had been too forward. She had mentioned this room, Monsieur's apartment, several times before. He couldn't imagine what could be so interesting about it, but by now he was dying to see it and insisted she show it to him. "If you promise to be good," she replied, her eyes widening. Through the darkness of the house, she led him into the room, which, to his delight, was a kind of temple of pleasure. There were mirrors on the walls, trompe d'oeil paintings evoking a forest scene, even a dark grotto, and a garlanded statue of Eros. Overwhelmed by the mood of the place, the young man quickly resumed what he'd started in the pavilion, and would have lost all track of time if a servant had not rushed in and warned them that it was getting light outside. Monsieur would soon be up. They quickly separated. Later that day, as the young man prepared to leave, his hostess said, "Goodbye, Monsieur. I owe you so many pleasures, but I have paid you with a beautiful dream. Now your love summons you to return. Don't give the Countess cause to quarrel with me." Reflecting on his experience on the way back, he could not figure out what it meant. He had the vague sensation of having been used, but the pleasures he remembered outweighed his doubts. Interpretation. Madame is a character in the 18th century libertine short story No Tomorrow by Vivant Denon. The young man is the story's narrator. Although fictional, Madame's techniques were clearly based on those of several well-known libertines of the time, masters of the game of seduction. And the most dangerous of their weapons was insinuation, the means by which Madame cast her spell on the young man, making him seem the aggressor, giving her the night of pleasure she desired, and safeguarding her guiltless reputation, all in one stroke. After all, he was the one who initiated physical contact. Or so it seemed. In truth, she was the one in control, planting precisely the ideas in his mind that she wanted. That first physical encounter in the carriage, for instance, that she had set up by inviting him closer. She later rebuked him for being forward, but what lingered in his mind was the excitement of the moment. Her talk of the Countess made him confused and guilty, but then she hinted that his lover was unfaithful, planting a different seed in his mind. Anger and the desire for revenge. Then she asked him to forget what she had said and forgive her for saying it, a key insinuating tactic. "I am asking you to forget what I have said, but I know you cannot," the thought will remain in your mind. Provoked this way, it was inevitable he would grab her in the pavilion. She several times mentioned the room in the chateau. Of course, he insisted on going there. She enveloped the evening in an air of ambiguity. Even her words, "If you promise to be good," could be read several ways. The young man's head and heart were inflamed with all of the feelings, discontent, confusion, desire, that she had indirectly instilled in him. Particularly in the early phases of a seduction, learn to make everything you say and do a kind of insinuation. Insinuate doubt with a comment here and there about other people in the victim's life, making the victim feel vulnerable. Slight physical contact insinuates desire, as does a fleeting but memorable look, or an unusually warm tone of voice, both for the briefest of moments. A passing comment suggests that something about the victim interests you. But keep it subtle, your words revealing a possibility, creating a doubt. You are planting seeds that will take root in the weeks to come. When you are not there, your targets will fantasize about the ideas you have stirred up and brood upon the doubts. They are slowly being led into your web, unaware that you are in control. How can they resist or become defensive if they cannot even see what is happening? Keys to seduction. You cannot pass through life without, in one way or another, trying to persuade people of something. Take the direct route, saying exactly what you want, and your honesty may make you feel good, but you're probably not getting anywhere. People have their own sets of ideas, which are hardened into stone by habit. Your words, entering their minds, compete with the thousands of preconceived notions that are already there, and get nowhere. Besides, people resent your attempt to persuade them, as if they were incapable of deciding by themselves, as if you knew better. Consider instead the power of insinuation and suggestion. It requires some patience and art, but the results are more than worth it. The way insinuation works is simple. Disguised in a banal remark or encounter, a hint is dropped. It's about some emotional issue, a possible pleasure not yet attained, a lack of excitement in a person's life. The hint registers in the back of the target's mind, a subtle stab at his or her insecurities. Its source is quickly forgotten. It's too subtle to be memorable at the time, and later, when it takes root and grows, it seems to have emerged naturally from the target's own mind, as if it was there all along. Insinuation lets you bypass people's natural resistance, for they seem to be listening only to what has originated in themselves. It's a language on its own, communicating directly with the unconscious. No seducer, no persuader can hope to succeed without mastering the language and art of insinuation. A strange man once arrived at the court of Louis XV. No one knew anything about him, and his accent and age were unplaceable. He called himself Count Saint-Germain. He was obviously wealthy. All kinds of gems and diamonds glittered on his jacket, his sleeves, his shoes, his fingers. He could play the violin to perfection, paint magnificently. But the most intoxicating thing about him was his conversation. In truth, the Count was the greatest charlatan of the 18th century, a man who had mastered the art of insinuation. As he spoke, a word here and there would slip out, a vague allusion to the philosopher's stone, which turned base metal into gold, or to the elixir of life. He did not say he possessed these things, but he made you associate him with their powers. Had he simply claimed to have them, no one would have believed him, and people would have turned away. The Count might refer to a man who had died 40 years earlier as if he had known him personally. Had this been so, the Count would have had to be in his 80s, although he looked to be in his 40s.
He mentioned the elixir of life. He seems so young.
The key to the Count's words was vagueness. He always dropped his hints into a lively conversation, grace notes in an ongoing melody. Only later would people reflect on what he had said. After a while, people started to come to him, inquiring about the Philosopher's Stone and the Elixir of Life, not realizing that it was he who had planted these ideas in their minds. Remember, to sow a seductive idea, you must engage people's imaginations, their fantasies, their deepest yearnings. What sets the wheels spinning is suggesting things that people already want to hear. The possibility of pleasure, wealth, health, adventure. In the end, these good things turn out to be precisely what you seem to offer them. They will come to you as if on their own, unaware that you insinuated the idea in their heads. In 1807, Napoleon Bonaparte decided it was critical for him to win the Russian Tsar Alexander I to his side. He wanted two things out of the Tsar, a peace treaty in which they agreed to carve up Europe and the Middle East, and a marriage alliance in which he would divorce his wife, Josephine, and marry into the Tsar's family. Instead of proposing these things directly, Napoleon decided to seduce the Tsar, using polite social encounters and friendly conversations as his battlefields, he went to work. An apparent slip of the tongue revealed that Josephine could not bear children. Napoleon quickly changed the subject. A comment here and there seemed to suggest a linking of the destinies of France and Russia. Just before they were to part one evening, he talked of his desire for children, sighed sadly, then excused himself for bed, leaving the Tsar to sleep on this. He escorted the Tsar to a play on the themes of glory, honor, and empire. Now, in later conversations, he could disguise his insinuations under the cover of discussing the play. Within a few weeks, the Tsar was speaking to his ministers of a marriage alliance and a treaty with France, as if they were his own ideas. Slips of the tongue, apparently inadvertent sleep-on-it comments, alluring references, statements for which you quickly apologize, all of these have immense insinuating power. They get under people's skin like a poison and take on a life of their own. The key to succeeding with your insinuations is to make them when your targets are at their most relaxed or distracted, so that they're not aware of what is happening. Polite banter is often the perfect front for this. People are thinking about what they will say next, or are absorbed in their own thoughts. Your insinuations will barely register, which is how you want it. In one of his early campaigns, John F. Kennedy addressed a group of veterans. Kennedy's brave exploits during World War II, the PT-109 incident, had made him a war hero, were known to all. But in the speech, he talked of the other men on the boat, never mentioning himself. He knew, however, that what he had done was on everyone's mind, because in fact he had put it there. Not only did his silence on the subject make them think of it on their own, it made Kennedy seem humble and modest, qualities that go well with heroism. In seduction, as the French courtesan Ninon de L'Enclos advised, it's better not to talk about your love for a person. Let your target read it in your manner. Your silence on the subject will have more insinuating power than if you had addressed it directly. Not only words insinuate. Pay attention to gestures and looks. Madame Récamier's favorite technique was to keep her words banal and the look in her eyes enticing. The flow of conversation would keep men from thinking too deeply about these occasional looks, but they would be haunted by them. Lord Byron had his famous underlook. While everyone was discussing some uninteresting subject, he would seem to hang his head, but then a young woman, the target, would see him glancing upward at her, his head still tilted. It was a look that seemed dangerous, challenging, but also ambiguous. Many women were hooked by it.
The face speaks its own language. We are used to trying to read people's faces, which are often better indicators of their feelings than what they say, which is so easy to control. Since people are always reading your looks, use them to transmit the insinuating signals you choose. Finally, the reason insinuation works so well is not just that it bypasses people's natural resistance, it is also the language of pleasure. There is too little mystery in the world. Too many people say exactly what they feel or want. We yearn for something enigmatic, for something to feed our fantasies. Because of the lack of suggestion and ambiguity in daily life, the person who uses them suddenly seems to have something alluring and full of promise. It's a kind of titillating game. What is this person up to? What does he or she mean? Hints, suggestions, and insinuations create a seductive atmosphere, signaling that their victim is no longer involved in the routines of daily life, but has entered another realm. Reversal. The danger in insinuation is that when you leave things ambiguous, your target may misread them. There are moments, particularly later on in a seduction, when it is best to communicate your idea directly, particularly once you know the target will welcome it. Casanova often played things that way. When he could sense that a woman desired him and needed little preparation, he would use a direct, sincere, gushing comment to go straight to her head like a drug and make her fall under his spell. When the rake and writer Gabriele D'Annunzio met a woman he desired, he rarely delayed. Flattery flowed from his mouth and pen. He would charm with his sincerity. Sincerity can be feigned, and is just one stratagem among others. This only works, however, when you sense that the target is easily yours. If not, the defenses and suspicions you raise by direct attack will make your seduction impossible. When in doubt, indirection is the better route.
Chapter 7. Enter Their Spirit. Most people are locked in their own worlds, making them stubborn and hard to persuade. The way to lure them out of their shell and set up your seduction is to enter their spirit. Play by their rules. Enjoy what they enjoy. Adapt yourself to their moods. In doing so, you will stroke their deep-rooted narcissism and lower their defenses. Hypnotized by the mirror image you present, they will open up, becoming vulnerable to your subtle influence. Soon, you can shift the dynamic. Once you have entered their spirit, you can make them enter yours, at a point when it's too late to turn back. Indulge your target's every mood and whim, giving them nothing to react against or resist. The Indulgent Strategy. In October of 1861, the American journalist Cindy Adams was granted an exclusive interview with President Sukarno of Indonesia. It was a remarkable coup, for Adams was a little-known journalist at the time, while Sukarno was a world figure in the midst of a crisis. A leader of the fight for Indonesia's independence, he had been the country's president since 1949, when the Dutch finally gave up the colony. By the early 1960s, his daring foreign policy had made him hated in the United States, some calling him the Hitler of Asia. Adams decided that in the interests of a lively interview, she wouldn't be cowed or overawed by Sukarno, and she began the conversation by joking with him. To her pleasant surprise, her ice-breaking tactic seemed to work. Sukarno warmed up to her. He let the interview run well over an hour, and when it was over, he loaded her with gifts. Her success was remarkable enough, but even more so were the friendly letters she began to receive from Sukarno after she and her husband had returned to New York. A few years later, he proposed that she collaborate with him on his autobiography. Adams, who was used to doing puff pieces on third-rate celebrities, was confused. She knew Sukarno had a reputation as a devilish Don Juan, le grand séducteur, the French called him. He had had 4 wives and hundreds of conquests. He was handsome, and obviously he was attracted to her, but why choose her for this prestigious task? Perhaps his libido was too powerful for him to care about such things. Nevertheless, it was an offer she could not refuse. In January of 1964, Adams returned to Indonesia. Her strategy, she had decided, would stay the same. She would be the brassy, straight-talking lady who had seemed to charm Sukarno 3 years earlier. During her first interview with him for the book, she complained in rather strong terms about the rooms she had been given as lodgings. As if he were her secretary, she dictated a letter to him, which he was to sign, detailing the special treatment she was to be given by one and all. To her amazement, he dutifully copied out the letter and signed it. Next on Adams' schedule was a tour of Indonesia to interview people who had known Sukarno in his youth. So she complained to him about the plane she had to fly on, which she said was unsafe. "I tell you what, honey," she told him, "I think you should give me my own plane." "Okay," he answered, apparently somewhat abashed. One, however, was not enough, she went on. She required several planes and a helicopter and her own personal pilot, a good one. He agreed to everything. The leader of Indonesia seemed to be not just intimidated by Adams, but totally under her spell. He praised her intelligence and wit. At one point he confided, "Do you know why I'm doing this biography? Only because of you. That's why." He paid attention to her clothes, complimenting her outfits, noticing any change in them. He was more like a fawning suitor than the Hitler of Asia. Inevitably, of course, he made passes at her. She was an attractive woman. First, there was a hand on top of her hand, then a stolen kiss. She spurned him every time, making it clear she was happily married. But she was worried. If all he had wanted was an affair, the whole book deal could fall apart. Once again, though, her straightforward strategy seemed the right one. Surprisingly, he backed down without anger or resentment. He promised that his affection for her would remain platonic. She had to admit that he was not at all what she had expected, or what had been described to her. Perhaps he liked being dominated by a woman. The interviews continued for several months, and she noticed slight changes in him. She still addressed him familiarly, spicing the conversation with brazen comments, but now he returned them, delighting in this kind of saucy banter. He assumed the same lively mood that she strategically forced on herself. At first, he had dressed in military uniform or in his Italian suits. Now, he dressed casually, even going barefoot, conforming to the casual style of their relationship. One night he remarked that he liked the color of her hair. It was Clairol, blue-black, she explained. He wanted to have the same color. She had to bring him a bottle. She did as he asked, imagining he was joking, but a few days later he requested her presence at the palace to dye his hair for him. She did so, and now they had the exact same hair color. The book, Sukarno, an autobiography as told to Cindy Adams, was published in 1965. To American readers' surprise, Sukarno came across as remarkably charming and lovable, which was indeed how Adams described him to one and all. If anyone argued, she would say that they did not know him the way she did. Sukarno was well pleased and had the book distributed far and wide. It helped gain sympathy for him in Indonesia, where he was now being threatened with a military coup. And Sukarno was not surprised. He had known all along that Adams would do a far better job with his memoirs than any serious journalist. Interpretation. Who was seducing whom? It was Sukarno who was doing the seducing, and his seduction of Adams followed a classical sequence. First, he chose the right victim. An experienced journalist would have resisted the lure of a personal relationship with the subject, and a man would have been less susceptible to his charm, and so he picked a woman, and one whose journalistic experience lay elsewhere. At his first meeting with Adams, he sent mixed signals. He was friendly to her, but hinted at another kind of interest as well. Then, having insinuated a doubt in her mind, perhaps he just wants an affair, he proceeded to mirror her. He indulged her every mood, retreating every time she complained. Indulging a person is a form of entering their spirit, letting them dominate for the time being. Perhaps Sukarno's passes at Adams showed his uncontrollable libido at work, or perhaps they were more cunning. He had a reputation as a Don Juan. Failing to make a pass at her would have hurt her feelings. Women are often less offended at being found attractive than one imagines, and Sukarno was clever enough to have given each of his four wives the impression that she was his favorite. The pass out of the way, he moved further into her spirit, taking on her casual air, even slightly feminizing himself by adopting her hair color. The result was that she decided he wasn't what she had expected or feared him to be. He wasn't in the least threatening, and after all, she was the one in control. What Adams failed to realize was that once her defenses were lowered, she was oblivious to how deeply he had engaged her emotions. She had not charmed him. He had charmed her. What he wanted all along was what he got, a personal memoir written by a sympathetic foreigner who gave the world a rather engaging portrait of a man of whom many were suspicious. Of all the seductive tactics, entering someone's spirit is perhaps the most devilish of all. It gives your victims the feeling that they are seducing you. The fact that you are indulging them, imitating them, entering their spirit suggests that you are under their spell. You aren't a dangerous seducer to be wary of, but someone compliant and unthreatening. The attention you pay to them is intoxicating. Since you're mirroring them, everything they see and hear from you reflects their own ego and tastes. What a boost to their vanity. All this sets up the seduction, the series of maneuvers that will turn the dynamic around. Once their defenses are down, they are open to your subtle influence. Soon you'll begin to take over the dance, and without even noticing the shift, they will find themselves entering your spirit. This is the end game. Keys to Seduction. One of the great sources of frustration in our lives is other people's stubbornness. How hard it is to reach them, to make them see things our way. We often have the impression that when they seem to be listening to us and apparently agreeing with us, it's all superficial. The moment we're gone, they revert to their own ideas. We spend our lives butting up against people, as if they were stone walls. But instead of complaining about how misunderstood or ignored you are, why not try something different? Instead of seeing other people as spiteful or indifferent, instead of trying to figure out why they act the way they do, look at them through the eyes of the seducer. The way to lure people out of their natural intractability and self-obsession is to enter their spirit. All of us are narcissists. When we were children, our narcissism was physical. We were interested in our own image, our own body, as if it were a separate being. As we grow older, our narcissism grows more psychological. We become absorbed in our own tastes, opinions, experiences. A hard shell forms around us. Paradoxically, the way to entice people out of the shell is to become more like them. In fact, a kind of mirror image of them. You don't have to spend days studying their minds. Simply conform to their moods, adapt to their tastes, play along with whatever they send your way. In doing so, you will lower their natural defensiveness.
Their sense of self-esteem doesn't feel threatened by your strangeness or different habits. People truly love themselves, but what they love most of all is to see their ideas and tastes reflected in another person. This validates them. Their habitual insecurity vanishes. Hypnotized by their mirror image, they relax. Now that their inner wall has crumbled, you can slowly draw them out and eventually turn the dynamic around. Once they're open to you, it becomes easy to infect them with your own moods and heat. Entering the other person's spirit is a kind of hypnosis. It is the most insidious and effective form of persuasion known to man. In the 18th century Chinese novel, The Dream of the Red Chamber, all the young girls in the prosperous house of Jia are in love with the rakish Bao Yu. He is certainly handsome, but what makes him irresistible is his uncanny ability to enter a young girl's spirit. Bao Yu has spent his youth around girls, whose company he's always preferred. As a result, he never comes over as threatening and aggressive. He's granted entry to girls' rooms. They see him everywhere, and the more they see him, the more they fall under his spell. It's not that Bao Yu is feminine. He remains a man, but one who can be more or less masculine as the situation requires. His familiarity with young girls allows him the flexibility to enter their spirit. This is a great advantage. The difference between the sexes is what makes love and seduction possible, but it also involves an element of fear and distrust. A woman may fear male aggression and violence. A man is often unable to enter a woman's spirit, and so he remains strange and threatening. The greatest seducers in history, from Casanova to John F. Kennedy, grew up surrounded by women and had a touch of femininity themselves. The philosopher Soren Kierkegaard, in his novel The Seducer's Diary, recommends spending more time with the opposite sex, getting to know the enemy and its weaknesses, so that you can turn this knowledge to your advantage. Ninon de l'Enclos, one of the greatest seductresses who ever lived, had definite masculine qualities. She could impress a man with her intense philosophical keenness and charm him by seeming to share his interest in politics and warfare. Many men first formed deep friendships with her, only to later fall madly in love. The masculine in a woman is as soothing to men as the feminine in a man is to women. To a man, a woman's strangeness can create frustration and even hostility. He may be lured into a sexual encounter, but a longer-lasting spell cannot be created without an accompanying mental seduction. The key is to enter his spirit. Men are often seduced by the masculine element in a woman's behavior or character. In the novel Clarissa by Samuel Richardson from 1748, the young and devout Clarissa Harlowe is being courted by the notorious rake Lovelace. Clarissa knows Lovelace's reputation, but for the most part, he hasn't acted as she would expect. He's polite, seems a little sad and confused. At one point, she finds out that he's done a most noble and charitable deed to a family in distress, giving the father money, helping the man's daughter get married, giving them wholesome advice. At last, Lovelace confesses to Clarissa what she has suspected. He wants to repent, to change his ways. His letters to her are emotional, almost religious in their passion. Perhaps she will be the one to lead him to righteousness. But of course, Lovelace has trapped her. He is using the seducer's tactic of mirroring her tastes, in this case, her spirituality. Once she lets her guard down, once she believes she can reform him, she is doomed. Now he can slowly insinuate his own spirit into his letters and encounters with her. Remember, the operative word is spirit, and that is often exactly where to take aim. By seeming to mirror someone's spiritual values, you can seem to establish a deep-rooted harmony between the two of you, which can then be transferred to the physical plane. When Josephine Baker moved to Paris in 1925 as part of an all-black review, her exoticism made her an overnight sensation. But the French are notoriously fickle, and Baker sensed that their interest in her would quickly pass to someone else. To seduce them for good, she entered their spirit. She learned French and began to sing in it. She started dressing and acting as a stylish French lady, as if to say that she preferred the French way of life to the American. Countries are like people. They have vast insecurities, and they feel threatened by other customs. It's often quite seductive to a people to see an outsider adopting their ways. Benjamin Disraeli was born and lived all his life in England, but he was Jewish by birth and had exotic features. The provincial English considered him an outsider. Yet he was more English in his manners and tastes than many an Englishman, and this was part of his charm, which he proved by becoming the leader of the Conservative Party. Should you be an outsider, as most of us ultimately are, turn it to advantage. Play on your alien nature in such a way as to show the group how deeply you prefer their tastes and customs to your own. In 1752, the notorious rake Saltykov determined to be the first man in the Russian court to seduce the 23-year-old Grand Duchess, the future Empress Catherine the Great. He knew that she was lonely. Her husband Peter ignored her, as did many of the other courtiers. And yet, the obstacles were immense. She was spied on day and night. Still, Saltykov managed to befriend the young woman and to enter her all-too-small circle. He finally got her alone and made it clear to her how well he understood her loneliness, how deeply he disliked her husband, and how much he shared her interest in the new ideas that were sweeping Europe. Soon, he found himself able to arrange further meetings where he gave her the impression that when he was with her, nothing else in the world mattered. Catherine fell deeply in love with him, and he did, in fact, become her first lover. Saltykov had entered her spirit. When you mirror people, you focus intense attention on them. They will sense the effort you're making and will find it flattering. Obviously, you have chosen them, separating them out from the rest. There seems to be nothing else in your life but them, their moods, their tastes, their spirit. The more you focus on them, the deeper the spell you produce and the intoxicating effect you have on their vanity. Many of us have difficulty reconciling the person we are right now with the person we want to be. We're disappointed that we have compromised our youthful ideals, and we still imagine ourselves as that person who had so much promise, but whom circumstances prevented from realizing it. When you're mirroring someone, don't stop at the person they've become. Enter the spirit of that ideal person they wanted to be. This is how the French writer Chateaubriand managed to become a great seducer despite his physical ugliness. When he was growing up in the latter 18th century, romanticism was coming into fashion, and many young women felt deeply oppressed by the lack of romance in their lives. Chateaubriand would reawaken the fantasy they had had as young girls of being swept off their feet, of fulfilling romantic ideals. This form of entering another's spirit is perhaps the most effective kind, because it makes people feel better about themselves. In your presence, they live the life of the person they had wanted to be, a great lover, a romantic hero, whatever it is. Discover those crushed ideals and mirror them, bringing them back to life by reflecting them back to your target. Few can resist such a lure. Reversal. In 1897, in Berlin, the poet Rainer Maria Rilke, whose reputation would later circle the world, met Lou Andrea Salome, the Russian-born writer and beauty who was notorious for having broken Nietzsche's heart. She was the darling of Berlin intellectuals, and although Rilke was 22 and she was 36, he fell head over heels in love with her. He flooded her with love letters, which showed that he had read all her books and knew her tastes intimately. The two became friends. Soon, she was editing his poetry, and he hung on her every word. Salome was flattered by Rilke's mirroring of her spirit, enchanted by the intense attention he paid her and the spiritual communion they began to develop. She became his lover, but she was worried about his future. It was difficult to make a living as a poet, and she encouraged him to learn her native language, Russian, and become a translator. He followed her advice so avidly that within months he could speak Russian. They visited Russia together, and Rilke was overwhelmed by what he saw: the peasants, the folk customs, the art, the architecture. Back in Berlin, he turned his rooms into a kind of shrine to Russia and started wearing Russian peasant blouses and peppering his conversation with Russian phrases. Now, the charm of his mirroring soon wore off. At first, Salome had been flattered that he shared her interests so intensely, but now she saw this as something else. He seemed to have no real identity. He had become dependent on her for his own self-esteem. It was all so slavish. In 1899, much to his horror, she broke off the relationship. The lesson is simple. Your entry into a person's spirit must be a tactic, a way to bring him or her under your spell. You cannot simply be a sponge, soaking up the other person's moods. Mirror them for too long, and they will see through you and be repelled by you. Beneath the similarity to them that you make them see, you must have a strong underlying sense of your own identity. When the time comes, you will want to lead them into your spirit. You cannot live on their turf. Never take mirroring too far, then. It is only useful in the first phase of a seduction. At some point, the dynamic must be reversed. Chapter 8. Create Temptation. Lure the target deep into your seduction by creating the proper temptation, a glimpse of the pleasures to come. As the serpent tempted Eve with the promise of forbidden knowledge, you must awaken a desire in your targets that they cannot control. Find that weakness of theirs, that fantasy that has yet to be realized, and hint that you can lead them toward it. It could be wealth, it could be adventure, it could be forbidden and guilty pleasures. The key is to keep it vague. Dangle the prize before their eyes, postponing satisfaction, and let their minds do the rest. The future seems ripe with possibility. Stimulate a curiosity stronger than the doubts and anxieties that go with it, and they will follow you. The Tantalizing Object. Sometime in the 1880s, a gentleman named Don Juan de Todellas was wandering through a park in Madrid when he saw a woman in her early 20s getting out of a coach, followed by a 2-year-old child and a nursemaid. The young woman was elegantly dressed, but what took Don Juan's breath away was her resemblance to a woman he'd known nearly 3 years before. Surely, she could not be the same person. The woman he had known, Cristeta Moreruela, was a showgirl in a second-rate theater. She had been an orphan and was quite poor. Her circumstances could not have changed that much. He moved closer, the same beautiful face, and then he heard her voice. He was so shocked that he had to sit down. It was indeed the same woman. Don Juan was an incorrigible seducer, whose conquests were innumerable and of every variety. But he remembered his affair with Cristeta quite clearly, because she had been so young, the most charming girl he had ever met. He had seen her in the theater, had courted her assiduously, and had managed to persuade her to take a trip with him to a seaside town. Although they had separate rooms, nothing could stop Don Juan. He made up a story about business troubles, gained her sympathy, and in a tender moment took advantage of her weakness. A few days later, he left her, on the pretext that he had to attend to business. He believed he would never see her again. Feeling a little guilty, a rare occurrence with him, he sent her 5,000 pesetas, pretending he would eventually rejoin her. Instead, he he went to Paris. He had only recently returned to Madrid. As he sat and remembered all this, an idea troubled him. The child. Could the boy possibly be his? If not, she must have married almost immediately after their affair. How could she do such a thing? She was obviously wealthy now. Who could her husband be? Did he know her past? Mixed with his confusion was intense desire. She was so young and beautiful. Why had he given her up so easily? Somehow, even if she was married, he had to get her back. Don Juan began to frequent the park every day. He saw her a few more times. Their eyes met, but she pretended not to notice him. Tracing the nursemaid during one of her errands, he struck up a conversation with her and asked her about her mistress's husband. She told him the man's name was Señor Martinez, and that he was away on an extended business trip. She also told him where Cristeta now lived. Don Juan gave her a note to give to her mistress. Then he strolled by Cristeta's house, a beautiful palace. His worst suspicions were confirmed. She had married for money. Cristeta refused to see him. He persisted, sending more notes. Finally, to avoid a scene, she agreed to meet him just once in the park. He prepared for the meeting carefully. Seducing her again would be a delicate operation. But when he saw her coming toward him in her beautiful clothes, his emotions and his lust got the better of him. She could only belong to him, never to another man, he told her. Cristeta took offense at this. Obviously, her present circumstances prevented even one more meeting. Still, beneath her coolness, he could sense strong emotions. He begged to see her again, but she left without promising anything. He sent her more letters, meanwhile racking his brains, trying to piece it all together. Who was this Señor Martinez? Why would he marry a showgirl? How could Cristeta be wrested away from him? Finally, Cristeta agreed to meet Don Juan one more time in the theater where he dared not risk a scandal. They took a box where they could talk. She reassured him the child wasn't his. She said he only wanted her now because she belonged to another, because he could not have her. No, he said, he had changed. He would do anything to get her back. Disconcertingly, at moments, her eyes seemed to be flirting with him. But then she seemed to be about to cry and rested her head on his shoulder, only to get up immediately, as if realizing this was a mistake. This was their last meeting, she said, and quickly fled. Don Juan was beside himself. She was playing with him. She was a coquette. He had only been claiming to have changed, but perhaps it was true. No woman had ever treated him this way before. He would never have allowed it. For the next few nights, Don Juan slept poorly. All he could think about was Cristeta. He had nightmares about killing her husband, about growing old and being alone. It was all too much. He had to leave town. He sent her a goodbye note, and to his amazement, she replied. She wanted to see him. She had something to tell him. By now, he was too weak to resist. As she had requested, he met her on a bridge at night. This time, she made no effort to control herself. Yes, she still loved Don Juan and was ready to run away with him, but he should come to her house tomorrow in broad daylight and take her away. There could be no secrecy. Beside himself with joy, Don Juan agreed to her demands. The next day, he showed up at her palace at the appointed hour and asked for Señora Martinez. There was no one there by that name, said the woman at the door. Don Juan insisted. Her name is Cristeta. Ah, Cristeta, the woman said. She lives in the back with the other tenants. Confused, Don Juan went to the back of the palace. There he thought he saw her son playing in the street in dirty clothes. But no, he said to himself, it must be some other child. He came to Cristeta's door, and instead of her servant, Cristeta herself opened it. He entered. It was the room of a poor person. Hanging on improvised racks, however, were Cristeta's elegant clothes. As if in a dream, he sat down, dumbfounded, and listened as Cristeta revealed the truth. She was not married, she had no child. Months after he had left her, she'd realized that she had been the victim of a consummate seducer.